Well, anyone who has spent time around teenagers know that sometimes they can perform in ways that we don't expect them to and take risks that we really wish that they wouldn't. And it can be hard to understand what's going on in their brains. Well, we're going to find out a little bit about that today. Becky Mather is an outreach specialist for the University of Wisconsin Cooperative Extension and the UW-Madison School of Human Ecology. And she's been doing really interesting work on risk-taking behavior in teens. Becky Mather, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
And what does your research say about the way teens make decisions in their adolescence? Why do they take more risks?
Well, there's been a lot of researchers that have been working on this lately. I think the thing that really spurred it were some actual changes in the medical field that allowed us to actually visually see what was going on in the teenage brain. And that kind of exploded onto the research fields, and people then got that information, the researchers got that information to the general public, and now it's starting to filter down to parents, and we realize that there's a huge amount going on in those brains that we didn't know until we could actually visually see them. So it's been really exciting, and I'd say there's probably three foci for why we now know there's so much change and risk-taking that goes on in the teen years. One is the origins of the human species. If you think about what happens during those years in our own homes, it's a real time of transition from being inside the home to getting ready to leave the home. And that's not really something new. We kind of do it differently now, but it's been going on for a long, long time. And so our teens' brains prepare themselves for that by beginning to adapt to those changes and to the needs to separate from their families of origin and start to go on their own. And in order to do that, it's scary. And in way olden times, it was physically threatening. And sometimes, I suppose it still is today.
Right, depending on the situation.
Exactly.
Definitely. And when we say teens, what ages are we really talking about? How long does this period of continued brain development go till?
Well, it really starts to begin to start to see some changes in late childhood, so 10, 11 years old. And now we know that it goes all the way into the mid-20s. And some researchers are even saying beyond that a little bit. So I think you can be pretty secure that it's still going on even after your kids are done with college.
Wow. So we could be talking like a 15-year span from 10 to, say, 25.
24, 25, you could. Yeah. And clearly some of the higher risk-taking kinds of things sort of peak in the mid-teens.
Mm-hmm. And is that related to hormonal changes that are going on too? Or does that just kind of add a whole nother layer?
It's all a big soup. So we've got the hormonal soup, we've got the brain soup, the changes, but it's not as related to hormonal changes as I think that we used to attribute to that particular.
Yeah, because I think we used to really focus on that kind of puberty period as, oh, they're just crazy, but really, their brains you hear the term like they're not fully cooked, but really in some ways they're still developing.
Yeah.
And so we can't expect them to act like they have an adult brain.
No. And when we start to really dig a little bit deeper, we find out that in fact, a lot of this stuff that seems so irrational actually makes a lot of sense.
Especially if you look at it in that kind of evolutionary
Evolutionary model, you realize, it makes a lot of sense. So
we are talking with Becky Mather about risk-taking behavior in teens, and we would like to have you join the conversation as well. Are you a parent of a teenager? Have you found that he or she is taking more risks and you're not sure how to deal with it? Becky can certainly offer some advice, and maybe you're curious about how to communicate with your teen about risky behavior. We'd be happy to talk about that as well. You can join us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also send us an email to talk@WPR.org or post a question or comment on our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mueller Show. So what parts of the teenage brain are still developing during that period? And what is the function of those parts of the brain?
So one of the things that we know is that by the mid-teens, so about age 16, the parts of the brain that are actually guiding the reasoning are pretty well developed, so that it, I don't think it's probably any surprise to any parents that are out there that their teens are pretty able to reason and to come up with some really innovative thoughts and ideas. It's the decision-making parts of the brain, or the prefrontal area, the cortex, that's really still under development for a number of years. And that is, those parts work together, but that's the part that really functions to help regulate the other processes that are going on in the brain. So it's not that teens can't think about things and reason. It's not even that they're unable to make good decisions. It's that those two processes don't work real well together in that time of life.
And I think that a common thought about teenagers is that they see themselves as invincible, and they don't think that possible negative consequences are something that will happen to them specifically. Is that part of that development that hasn't quite finished?
Well, it is and it isn't. So we've found that researchers have asked teens, how are you making this decision? What have you decided in terms of something that might be very risky? And probably, again, no surprise to parents, they are amazingly adept at, in a lab situation, at very clearly telling why this might not be a good choice, or what might be going on. But there's a number of factors in real life that have a strong influence on that. So the context is really, really important. If you could put your child into a sealed lab, sort of like the room that I'm in right now, they probably could make perfect decisions, but that's not where they live.
Right, right.
So they're heavily influenced by the situation, by peers, and also we've also found that by asking them that they tend to have a slightly different value system than their parents do in terms of what might be worth the risk. Mm.
And what's an example of that? Like how might their brain gauge a risk that we might as adults gauge differently?
So if a parent is standing at the proverbial top of the bridge and thinking about whether to jump off, probably it's not a huge influence about whether your friend John, who's standing next to you, is going to have a lesser opinion of you if you do that. Mm. But that has a huge effect on how a teen perceives that. And so sometimes the risk of John's perception is much higher than in their mind than the risk of getting hurt.
It seems like sometimes teens exaggerate their own importance. Like they're so self-focused and inwardly focused. It seems like that would, in a negative way, play into that idea of peer pressure, because to them, if they do something or don't do something, everyone's going to notice, everyone's going to think about it, everyone's going to focus on them. Is that part of the, it almost seems like that self-obsession might actually be, in the evolutionary sense, a positive thing that just doesn't come off that well in modern situations.
Yeah. Well, another thing that we've learned is that teens are really learning to, a big part of their adolescent development is learning to negotiate social situations, and that they're not particularly necessarily adept at that yet. There's a really interesting piece of research where a researcher actually showed faces to teens and to adults, and discovered that the teens attributed a sad face as exhibiting anger sometimes. So sometimes they're even misreading facial expressions, which is really interesting if you're a parent, because sometimes you can be having a discussion with your child and it kind of goes from 0 to 60 really fast. Mm-hmm. And if you think about that, you realize, oh, if they're interpreting my excitement or concern as anger, that would explain right. why this just happened. So it's physically being able to see expressions and interpret them correctly. It's interpreting social situations in adeptly as time goes on, and they're all negotiating and learning that. So that's part of the process. And yes, there is also a component of everyone's looking at me, the whole world is a stage, and I appear to be the only person in the middle of it right now.
Right. And so that's really interesting that they might not be able to read the same kind of body language or facial cues that the rest of us, or many of us at least, can take for granted that we're reading more or less correctly. As a parent, how would you recommend someone kind of working to counter that deficiency on the part of their teenager?
So I think I probably would give the same message for almost all of the stuff that we're talking about today, is a central message, and that's awareness. The more you're aware of these issues being the case, the more you're aware that your child might be misinterpreting your passion under those circumstances or might be valuing things differently, the more that you can compensate for that with them and just be understanding. So it's a learning process, and they're in the process of learning. And sometimes we're expecting, because on the outside they look so mature, that they should be that mature on the inside. Mm-hmm. And just as their bodies are eating differently and they're growing and sleeping differently, their brains need us to understand them cognitively and emotionally differently too.
Even though it might feel kind of artificial to do it, might it be helpful for a parent to actually say, you know, I'm really sad about this, or to actually verbalize the emotions that they're feeling instead of thinking that they're conveying them in other ways, but kind of let's make sure we all know what's going on here. This is how I'm feeling.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think the clarity and the conversation is important, or talking out a situation and trying to interpret how someone else might be feeling. So that if a student comes home, a common scenario would be with a teacher. The teacher doesn't like me. Well, what might be the circumstances that are around that? Could you be misinterpreting that? Could that teacher just be having a bad day? Or could their facial expression not be conveying what you're seeing?
Mm-hmm. We are talking with Becky Mather about risk-taking behavior in teens. You can join in by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Has risk-taking behavior in teens changed over the years, or is it pretty consistent? Are teens taking kind of the same level of risks as maybe teens 50 or 100 years ago, or do we not have the data to really compare?
I'm not sure. I personally don't know of data that's necessarily comparing it, but I think that thinking about the changes in our culture gives us a pretty good insight as to what might be different. One thing that we do know is that teens have a lot more time on their hands now than they did. When you think about an agrarian society, kids are working. And even an apprenticeship, they were out working. They were expected to help support their families at that point. We have this long transitional time when kids have the opportunity to get into more trouble. They have more time on their hands and more money and certain prevalence of certain things. One really, really high risk factor, for instance, is driving. Mm-hmm. That's the number one cause of accidents, are the number one cause of death in teens, and the number one cause of accidents is driving. There's a lot more cars on the road than there would have been when my grandparents were young. So right there, that's going to
right. And more kids have access to those cars. Because
exactly.
Our grandparents had cars, they probably weren't letting their kids drive them. They were for very specific uses for the family or for individuals. And I know that period of time when a child is about to get a driver's license can be very stressful for parents. We have a lot more to talk about with Becky Mather about risk-taking behavior in teens. After a look at the news, you can join in at 1-800-642-1234. I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're getting a rare glimpse inside the teenage brain and finding out why adolescents are more inclined to take risks. Hi, I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking with Becky Mather, an outreach specialist for the University of Wisconsin Cooperative Extension and the UW-Madison School of Human Ecology. She conducts research in parenting education and adolescent development. If you have questions for her, maybe what makes your teen do what he or she does, or how to best communicate with your teen, you can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can leave a question or comment on our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mueller Show. Becky Mather, thanks so much for spending time with us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
It's a really fascinating topic, and I think something that whether we look back on our own teenage years or have been the parents or adults close to teenagers, a lot of the behavior can leave us scratching our heads. And one of the things we talked about was whether or not teens are taking more risks today than they did in the past. And what you were saying was that there are just a lot more opportunities today, partly because of leisure and access to things like cars we were talking about. Actually, a caller said he saw teenage boys in a car trying to reach out the speeding car window to touch a semi-trailer as it was going by. I think that's the kind of behavior that we all think, what were you thinking? How did that seem to be a good idea? But one of the things I think that has changed dramatically in just maybe the last 10 years is social media. And it can be a great tool for a lot of things. Unfortunately, it's also a perfect outlet for risky behavior.
Yes, it is. It's a real conundrum. And especially if those of us that are interested in teens right now are really kind of struggling with the dichotomy between the fact that it can be a very high risk arena depending on how behaviors occur. I think everybody's heard about situations of bullying and where it's gone bad. On the other hand, it can be a very developmentally positive arena also, because it's an opportunity. Think of it sort of as the new mulch shop. That's where a lot of teens go to build their social skills, and they have access to it, fortunately, unfortunately, pretty much 24/7. Right. And they don't really want you in the mulch shop. So right. They are trying to keep adults and parents having relatively limited access to what they're doing, which does create some risk. So there's a lot of schools as to how to deal with that. Extension has worked on helping parents to negotiate social media a little bit better. They have a program called e-parenting, which is online that talks about how to use online resources and social media in order to positively parent and help your child. So I think that there's a lot of ways to look at it. But it is definitely something that you want to make sure that you are keeping a handle on and watch. Try to keep your ear to the ground and hear about some of the new apps or resources. The unfortunate thing is, like most risk-taking, the minute you discover something, the kids have discovered something else.
it seems like they're always a step or two ahead. But I think we will put that link to that e-parenting program from Extension up on the Facebook page, either now or after the show. But I do think that it goes back to that kind of assessing long-term potential consequences and whether it's worth it or not. And unfortunately, I think teens often think, oh, it's worth it, whereas adults would say, maybe not. And a lot of things on social media, while they seem very immediate, can have a very long shelf life, and that can come back to haunt you later.
Well, and one of the difficulties is that we already know from the things that we've talked about with the brain that teens do have a hard time assessing risk in the same way that adults do. So in a even-keeled environment, they can do pretty well. But the thing about social media is that you don't see that person. And you don't necessarily have the visual sense that there are a whole bunch of people out there and this has really long-term consequences. And that's not something that they assess very well already. So it's kind of a mix of bad and bad sometimes when things go awry. On the other hand, it's in some cases it can be a very, very positive environment for kids.
Right. So, where especially kids who might feel isolated in their physical environment can find a community online that is supportive for them.
Absolutely. Or if they have some kind of an interest that's very narrow, and often our teens do, they know a lot about some very obscure thing that we know nothing about, they can find a community that does it. And they use social media in order to enhance other general aspects of their social life, too. I'm guessing any parents of teens out there, or even very young teens, know that Friday night doesn't happen without texting. So,
it's very true. Let's go to the phones, and William in Barneveld is up. Hi, William.
Hi. Thanks very much for taking my call.
Sure.
It's a great topic. I'm the father of a 17-year-old daughter, and this is very interesting. And I just have two comments. One is, I think this explains probably in part why, unfortunately, our youth make such malleable recruits for the armed forces because of their, sort of relish in risk-taking. The second was, I appreciate the guest's focus on just having awareness about this for parents. And because when I first turned on the program, it sounded a bit like the program is predicated on how do we use this awareness to reduce the risk-taking in our kids. And I want to ask is that, should we really be doing that? And I'm thinking of, you know, if you did an experiment, say you had 1,000 kids and you just let them engage in risk-taking behavior, and you had 1,000 kids that you protected from risk-taking, and let's say the 1,000 kids that had risk-taking behavior, maybe, you know, say 1% of them die from the risks or are injured, you know, 30 years out, can you really say in which group you'll find more happiness, more self-actualized human beings, and more contribution to society? Will it really be in the protected group, or will it be in the kids that are allowed to take risks? And also, and I would point out that, yes, the parents' assessment of risk is different from the kids, but it's not necessarily superior. Sometimes the parents' assessment of risk is too conservative and restricts kids from taking chances, you know, going for some profession that they love and so forth.
Hmm. Those are all great points, William. Thank you. So, Becky Mather, I think, you know, kind of at the core, William is saying, should we be trying to reduce risk-taking behavior in teens? Is that necessarily the goal?
So I'm really excited that William brought that up today, because that is a really, really important factor. And in fact, I would agree with him that we don't necessarily want to get rid of risk-taking behavior in teens, that that's an important part of development and growth. And I think if parents really looked inside their hearts and their wishes for their teens, they'd say, yes, I want my teen to take risks, because that's how they learn, and that's how they develop and they create new interests. And even if we wanted to get rid of their risk-taking, we wouldn't be able to anyway. So there's some things that we need to do to manage that risk. And so there's a big difference between trying to get rid of something mm-hmm. and try to direct it into a more healthy, positive direction. And management sort of can take two forms. One is by creating structures around your teen that don't necessarily allow them to have unmitigated risk.
Right, right.
And also by putting opportunities in their path, and I think this is something that sometimes we don't think of quite as much, that allow them opportunities to take healthy risks, big risks. And it's amazing how different you can think about risk if you really try to wrap your mind about your own individual child. For some children, a huge risk is standing on stage and talking to a bunch of people. That can be huge risk-taking behavior for a child that you might see at home that seems to be a clown all the time and laughing and always socializing. That doesn't necessarily compute to that arena. And so that would be a very good, healthy risk to put in their way, because it will be adaptive at a later stage of their life.
And I'm guessing that you're not saying, you know, just shove them out on stage and kind of sink or swim, but really supporting them in a way that says, I believe you can do this. I think you're going to be great. Why don't you give this a try? You know, why don't you try out for this play? You don't have to, you know, become an actor as a result, but why don't you give it a try? You might find it's fun. So, you know, kind of helping them push their own boundaries a little bit. Would that be a good way of saying it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Providing opportunities. Even when your children were very young, I'm sure most parents are thinking, what are some opportunities that I can provide that will just allow them to experience new facets of themselves? Mm-hmm. We need to continue to do that with our teens. And more, I think it's a more subtle art, because saying to our teens, as you said, you're going on stage and that's all there is to it, it's not going to be as effective as perhaps putting that bug in their ear. Some things they'll take us up on. Others, they won't. There are other ways of supporting, too. I think that in the teen years, mentors are really, really important for our kids. We used to have structures where there were more adults in just general life, perhaps, interacting with kids, and apprenticeships mm-hmm. that took them.
And even extended family situations.
Extended family situations. Often now, our teens can be really isolated from adult situations. I heard a story about somebody that was a really interesting perspective about preschoolers, and the fact that we talk about socializing preschoolers in childcare or in preschool programs, which is a good thing. But they said, wouldn't you rather have them working with a social expert, like a parent or an adult? And so there's some balance there. Mm-hmm. And I think the same thing in our kids' teen years. It's great for them to socialize with their peers and their teachers, but a little bit of balance with other mentors in their life can be really, really helpful too. And I think that that's an opportunity for them to explore a new skill at the same time. Mm-hmm. So that can be a really helpful tool for parents.
Talking about the teenage brain and especially how it dictates risk-taking behavior and how we as adults can support them while they take those sometimes very necessary risks to develop. Becky Mather is our guest, outreach specialist for the University of Wisconsin Cooperative Extension and the UW-Madison School of Human Ecology. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'd especially like to hear from parents of maybe currently teens or recently teens and how you kind of saw that risk-taking behavior manifest itself and how you dealt with it. If you feel like you kind of hit on a good formula, we'd love to hear about that. If you feel like maybe you missed it a little bit, we'd be happy to hear your experiences about that as well. Again, 800-642-1234. Jason in Madison wonders, is there a difference between boys' and girls' brains and at what rate they develop?
Well, there are differences in boys' and girls' brains. I can't actually tell him because I don't know if there's a difference in terms of overall development. But certainly there's a difference in social structures and how teens are more likely to manifest risks. Mm. Girls, I think it's the things that we're pretty aware of unconsciously, but girls are much more likely to have it be an interpersonal type of risk, whereas boys are more likely to enjoy more physical types of risk. But that's not universal, and we have a lot of girls that are out there snowboarding and rock climbing and certainly jumping out of parachutes, doing those kinds of things too.
When you say interpersonal risk, what do you mean?
Well, I would mean more relationship types of negotiation things. So you certainly see, there's certainly things on social media, for instance, that get out of control with boys involved, but it's a little bit more likely to happen with girls and with the kinds of discussions that they might have, the kinds of emotional manipulation that they're a little bit more, they have a little bit more expertise with at times.
And a caller said, I was bullied as a teen about 10 years ago. I think that schools and adults take it more seriously now. Can you comment on the teen brain and bullying? What's the connection there?
Well, I was actually recently reading something about risk taking and the fact that can sort of push into the bullying arena. Certainly the issue of peers and the importance of peers can push teens to do things that they wouldn't otherwise do or put them in vulnerable situations. Mm-hmm. Also that lack of inhibition perhaps causes kids sometimes to do things that later on in adulthood they wouldn't do, which does cause a bullying type of situation. So it does contribute. I don't know that there's a direct line contribution, but indirectly there's a relationship. And yes, I would agree that adults take that much, much more seriously. Mm-hmm. This is another example, though, of the brain really struggling to learn to negotiate those social contexts and social situations and making sometimes some pretty drastic mistakes. I know that there are certainly people that have been bullied in really horrendous ways. A lot of times, not quite so drastic mistakes. And there's opportunities to really learn a lot more about negotiating situations. Even in my own life, I have a daughter that really sort of struggled to work through some of the social situations that she dealt with. And she jokes all the time, she's 25 now, that I said to her, some kids go to school in order to get knowledge. You go to school in order to learn how to get along with people.
Interesting. Wow. And, you know, the bullying topic, of course, that's a whole huge topic and not the main focus of the show today. But it seems like there's a component in bullying that is a lack of empathy, because if you thought about you know, how would I feel if someone was doing what I'm doing to this other person? Is part of that brain development related to empathy, or do other things just override it during that period?
So a lot of the structures in the adolescent brain are basically in place. It's, as I said before, the integration or the working together of those things. And I think that empathy would be a good example of things working together. That's perspective taking. Can you take someone else's perspective? Can you really have an idea about what something that you, the longer term effect of what might happen when you do something? And a lot of those structures are not really fully developed.
Let's go back to the phones and Paul in Two Rivers. Hi, Paul.
Hi.
Hi.
I operate an online service that helps high school students find volunteer opportunities and work-based learning opportunities and then record their records online. And oftentimes I'm dealing with parents. Even this morning I received a call from a parent who wanted a little help, you know, in straightening out some students' records. The program's called Get Involved, it's used by high schools to manage, basically, community service. Now, there's lots of schools in our area who do have community service requirements, and I think that's just excellent. The idea of students going out there and working with those other adults, as your guest had mentioned, in a very structured, formalized manner that's recorded and observable by not just the teachers but the parents as well. Not only does this develop interpersonal relationships between the students and their worksite mentors, it also develops a relationship between the school as an entity and those other entities in the community that are woven together to form the net that, you know, we all are helped by. So I guess what I'm saying is the idea of looking, having parents look over the shoulders of students while they're doing this, especially the kind of work that I'm involved in, it's really important because parents need to know who are the other adults that their children relate to.
Thanks so much for that call, Paul. And Becky?
Yes, I would agree. I think that contribution is really, really important. The skills that teens are able to get out of those experiences are very multidimensional, from social types of negotiation skills to a sense of contribution. When we talked about this prolonged adolescence, I think that that's something that tends to sometimes get lost, that teens want to be able to contribute. It's a very passionate time in your life. You feel things very, very strongly, and you want to be able to give and feel like there's you have a purpose. We all need to have a purpose, but mm-hmm. that can be a time when that sometimes feels like it kind of gets lost. So being able to contribute to the community really solidifies that sense of purpose and that you have value.
Thanks for that call. I want to go back a little bit and get some more maybe concrete advice for parents on encouraging that healthy risk taking, because, you know, I think even when we're not entirely comfortable with the teens taking risks, we know that it is an important developmental step. So we talked about maybe encouraging them, you know, to step outside their comfort zones in some ways. What are some other ways that parents can really kind of encourage that?
Well, I want to step back and say the first thing, once again, is awareness that this is a healthy part of life. And I think one of our callers mentioned, too, that it's sometimes difficult for parents to allow some of those risks. So one of the things that's important for parents to think about is how can I make an important risk for my child as safe as I can? So if your child is a very physical person, physical challenges might be really important. And if they're a big rock climber, for instance, or outdoor person, what you might need to do is make sure they're going with the correct people to do that or wearing the correct equipment. Mm-hmm. But realize that there is a certain level of danger involved. I'm a horseback rider. I have horses now, and I've had them ever since I was young. And I really didn't realize until I started doing that again in my adulthood how incredibly risky that was. And I haven't really encouraged my children to do that because they aren't that interested. But I myself and my parents had to take a risk in order to allow me to do something that was really, really important to me. And I think that when you look at that and you've kind of created the context around it that makes things as safe as they possibly can for that kind of risk, you have to realize, well, if something happens to my child, they're happy while they're doing it and learning.
And I think also maybe figuring out a way for them safely to spend time in another culture or another country or maybe even just another state, experiencing a different way of life, as long as it's, you know, you check out that it's going to be a safe environment, that's a really good way for them to kind of try on themselves as an individual outside of their own family as well.
Absolutely. I really, really would say that that's an excellent thing to endorse if you have a child that's interested in that kind of adventure. Some are and some aren't. And it's a great way to learn those social skills that we were talking about, because when you're negotiating across cultures, you have to be very aware of your perspective, of your social skills, and also about what your culture entails, because you'll be asked to speak to that.
Right.
So that's an excellent opportunity, as long as parents have put the supports in place so that they know that their child is going to a place where they'll be well supervised and they'll be safe and hopefully not exposed to something that would put them in an overly vulnerable situation.
Well, Becky Mather, the time just flew by. Thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Becky Mather is an outreach specialist for the University of Wisconsin Cooperative Extension and the UW-Madison School of Human Ecology. We have a link up on the Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show, to an article about her research on teenage brains and risk-taking. And we'll also put the e-parenting link up as well.
We also have a site that I would like to recommend to all the parents out there for more information. It's at www.myparenthetical.com, which just gives information on a variety of topics.
All right. We will put that up. Well, I hope you'll stay tuned to the Ideas Network. Lots more in store. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson in for Larry Mueller.